Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, October 9th. Days after the two-year anniversary of a Hamas attack on Israel, word of a possible peace deal, we get reaction. We take a closer look at hundreds of millions of federal funds earmarked to help needy families, why Hawaii has left that money unspent. And we hear of genetic studies underway in American Samoa that could impact other Pacific Island communities. Plus, we tip our hats to Jane Goodall, a powerhouse in the primate world, who we lost recently. We hear from a board member of one of her institutes who reflects on her legacy. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. 2 years ago, when Hamas attacked Israel and kidnapped more than 200 hostages, one of the first people that we connected with for our coverage was Maddie Gorondachik. He was working as a teacher and coach at Kaimuki High School. He remembered when his sister called him during the middle of a football game at Pearl City High School. She was terrified because Hamas was in the home she was hiding in, and she called her brother to say goodbye. We last talked to him on the one-year anniversary of the war in Gaza. He has since moved to Boston, but the ache over this bloody conflict remains. We talked to him this morning, and he shared that an uncle of a childhood friend was one of the hostages killed and whose body has yet to be returned home. Under the agreement reached by Israel and Hamas, roughly 20 surviving hostages and the bodies of 24 others could be released as soon as next week.
On October 7 itself, I reached out to her, and I just wanted to see how she's doing. And it's interesting. It's a very Israeli thing to do. She said, Mati, we need to celebrate his life no matter what. We can't wait for him to be back for burial properly here in Israel. But if we're just going to be depressed and sad, this is not how he would want us to live our lives. This is not who he is. So we need to be happy and make jokes and laugh and remember. And that changed my October 7 day. Because I woke up in the morning all depressed and sad and remembering how my day was 2 years ago. And now with the new ceasefire, peace deal, call it whatever they call it, there's hope. There's hope for the hostages to come back. There's hope for things to calm down. There's hope that things will get better, because how low can it go? We can only go up.
Your friend, her uncle, then his body is still with Hamas.
Yes. Yeah, the body is still kept. He's one of the 48 hostages that is in Gaza. And we know for a fact that he was murdered on October 7th. Back then, we weren't sure yet, right after. But we know for a fact that he's among the dead hostages.
We hope that they are able to see the return of his body and have proper funeral services.
Yeah. We want that. We want that for his family, for his friends. There's a burial spot that they have in just waiting for him with his name on it, just waiting for it to be brought back. So, again, we hope to see it happening as soon as possible. Everyone with a heart, I think, wants this to be over. The past 2 years have been a total agony on so many people. It's been tough. Like, for Jewish people, for the civilian people in Gaza, it was tough. It's hard to be Jewish in America these days. Like, I can't speak on behalf of Palestinian people. I'm not a Palestinian. I can only speak on my behalf. But it's not an easy thing to be Jewish. It's not an easy thing to tell someone that you're even Israeli. Someone told me on October 7, when we were celebrating Sukkot, we were sitting in a hut. So it's a celebration that we have now to remind us the time that we were walking in the desert. And she said something that really touched me. She said, there's Jewish people. We were the Jewish people of October 6, 2023. And then there's the Jewish people of October 8, 2023. And our life has changed ever since. Because a one day in between changed us. And people lost I feel fortunate because I got a lot of support from my non-Jewish friends. But a lot of people lost friends, peers, people that they had great relationships with because of opinions. And it's tough. It's tough on a lot of people. And people, a lot of Jewish people feel like that we got, in the past 2 years, a little bit of the Holocaust in our days. All of a sudden, anti-Semitism is on the rise. We see what happened in Manchester in England and everywhere in the world, basically. People are uncomfortable to walk around with any Jewish symbol on them. It's not an easy thing. And I really hope that this agreement that we have now is going to bring an end to this. And with the hope that not things will change in the Middle East, but things will change all over the world. Because enough is enough. We can't be living based on hate. We can't support people who support hate. We need to respect each other. We need to acknowledge each other. And I'm talking about everyone. I'm talking about Jews, Israelis, Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, Christians, Hawaiians, whoever you want. Without looking at the world in this way, there is no future for anyone. We will just continue to live October 7th in one way or another.
When I reached out to you earlier this week, you said you were hoping for a new Gaza Strip where tolerance and the acceptance of their neighbors is taught, and you want to live side by side with the Palestinians with no terrorist organizations controlling them. You told me that they deserve a better life. And the loss is just staggering from when we talked a year ago and 2 years ago. Anything else you want to add?
I just really hope that this agreement that came thanks to the effort by the United States, by countries in the region, I don't know, Saudi, UAE, Egypt, because they are the ones who are actually capable of holding the Palestinian leadership accountable. And I think the Abraham Accord makes a huge difference. I visited the UAE, and it was amazing to me. As an Israeli, as an American, as a Jew, it was an amazing experience for me to visit the UAE. And I really believe that people can make changes. There's going to be needed a change within the Israeli society also, because it's a broken society. It's a society that October 7th changed it. Change the mindset of a lot of people. And I hope that there's going to be a change within the Palestinian Authority, and within, we don't want Hamas to control anything over there. We really believe that I personally believe that everything starts with education. I'm an educator. Everything starts within the school system. Everything. And I want, the first thing that needs to be rebuilt there are the school infrastructures and all of that. So kids have a place to go. So kids have a place to be a kids again. And learn that things can be better. So that is my hope. And I hope I'm not telling myself stories that things are going to be better, but I'm actually hoping for that.
And how is your family? Because I know you were worried for them when they were in their safe house 2 years ago and Hamas was in their home. Are they doing okay?
Everyone's doing okay. My sister, for example, that the terrorists were pretty close to where she lives. They added a new part to the house that is a safe room that once you're inside and you lock yourself inside, it's almost impossible to break in. And it's a wild thing to think about that people need that in their life to feel safe. I had one niece back then, and now I have a second niece that joined the family. And all I want them is to grow up and be happy and smile, because every day that I get pictures from my sister of them smiling and doing things together is the best thing I can think of. That's all I want for them. That's all I can wish for kids. Yeah, it's growing up in the Middle East is definitely an amazing experience. It's very different than growing up in Hawaii or anywhere else in America. But it's looking back from my comfort of my house over here, it's a very different thing than what kids experience anywhere in the Western world. So I just hope that they'll get the best childhood they can get.
One of the people that we interviewed also because of this conflict was a gentleman who grew up in the Palestinian refugee camps, and he has lost scores of relatives in the conflict there. Is there anything you want to say to him or the Palestinians who have suffered loss?
If anyone lost anyone that didn't do anything, that just lived their lives, I mourn for them. I really do. And I hope that they can feel the same thing to Israelis who didn't do anything besides waking up in the morning and living their life. And I hope that we can all sit together and eat hummus together and eat falafel together and eat shawarma together, because at the end of the day, we all eat the same food and we all love the same food. And food brings people together. And it's a joke I made with an Arab friend of mine a couple of days ago, and I mean it. I want to sit down with everyone and just laugh and enjoy life and share that land that we both care about so deeply.
Yes, we hope that you can break bread and pray for peace. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing your thoughts as this deal has been just signed.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me the time. And if I can just, I just want to mention, if I can, names of three people that I personally know who lost their life in October 7th, and we will never forget them. And all they did was try and protect and save other people's life, and they sacrificed their life. And the first of them is obviously my friend's uncle, Leo Rodaev, that we hope to see his body back in Israel soon. He was an ambulance driver, and he cared about everyone in his life. The second person is David Newman, who was one of my players when I coached football in Israel, and he was murdered during the Nova Festival because he just went to dance. And the third person is someone I know named Ziv Dado, who's a father and a loving husband. And he did the same thing. He just went out there, tried to save people's life on that horrible morning. There's just three names out of 1,200 names that were killed that day, unfortunately.
All right, Maddie, thank you so much for your time. And stay safe.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Aloha. That was Maddie Goronicek, a former Kaimuki High School teacher and football coach, who tells us that his best friend's family is anxiously awaiting the return of their uncle's body as part of the Gaza peace deal.
I'm Anita Rao. Embodied is WUNC's weekly radio show and podcast about sex, relationships, and health. Join me to meet people who aren't afraid to question what we think we know about intimacy, who are embracing the unique ways their bodies shape their lived experience, and who have some fascinating stories to share about their relationships. We'll take on the taboo together next time on Embodied.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
You know, there is much hand-wringing over pending cuts of federal funds to help needy families, but Hawaii is one of several states which has hundreds of millions of unspent federal dollars. Here with more on that is HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, and people are probably scratching their heads or like, what?
We have unspent money? So the program that we're going to be talking about is called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or it's going to be referred to as TANF for most of this conversation. It's a federal block grant given every year to states to help, you know, low-income families meet their basic needs. It's most commonly given as direct cash assistance to eligible families for up to 5 years, but it can also be used on things like work support programs or job training or after school or pre-K programs. The state gets about $99 million a year, and it currently has over $400 million in unspent funds from that program. It has the fourth largest reserve of TANF funds in the country. Here's Tax Foundation of Hawaii President Tom Yamachika.
One of the big problems is that when you compare Hawaii's unobligated balance to the amount of money that the feds give us in a year, we are hoarding 4.5 years worth of federal monies, which is not even close to what other states do.
I like what he says, hoarding.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the amount of money can kind of fluctuate a little bit between like 400, 450 million, depending on how much they're spending at a time. But generally speaking, about $400 million to $450 million are in that TANF reserve. These funds don't expire, so it can just be carried over year to year to year, which is why the state's reserve has gotten so large. You know, according to a report by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities as of 2022, which is their most recent analysis, for every 100 families in Hawaii in poverty, 23 are getting TANF assistance, which compared to the rest of the country is actually quite high. But what I thought was really interesting is that, you know, since this TANF was created and Hawaii started getting these monies, you know, Hawaii has actually seen the most dramatic drop in the ratio of families in poverty compared to the number of those getting TANF assistance in the country. So that ratio has really dropped considerably over the years.
So then why do we have such a high reserve?
Yeah, so largely it was due to the federal law, which didn't allow COFA residents to receive most federal benefits. And, you know, that's Palau, the Marshall Islands, and Federated States of Micronesia. They share treaties with the U.S. where residents can migrate visa-free to the country in exchange for using their land for military positioning in the Pacific. But when that was signed in like 1996, you know, they didn't have access to most federal programs. But the state constitution requires that all benefits go to eligible residents equally. Benefit Employment and Support Services Division Administrator Scott Morishige says it made expanding the program difficult.
Prior to last year in 2024, when Congress passed the Consolidated Appropriations Act, COFA residents were not eligible. Most federally funded programs, including TANF. So anytime we considered a potential use of funds from the TANF reserve, we needed to look at setting aside a comparable amount, you know, of general funds, non-federal funds, to be able to provide equivalent services to that population. But now, because the law has changed and that population is now eligible for federal funds, we have a little bit more flexibility in who that funding stream can serve, and it no longer requires necessarily that non-federal match for it.
So up until last year, you know, any expansion to TANF in the state required the state to set aside state monies so that they could serve COFA residents. But now the law was changed last year by Congress. That's no longer the case. And so that's why in March, the state was actually able to increase the TANF benefit to families. So a family of four will now get about $250 more a month than they did before. They're also using the TANF funding to support after-school programs and exploring ways that they can use those funds for housing support programs, and even thinking about how these funds can be used to transition people off of the program to mitigate, you know, that cliff effect when people lose their assistance as they enter the workforce. Morishige says another positive to having such a large reserve is that it can be used to respond to emergencies like supporting Maui residents after the fires.
We're able to help those households with up to 4 months of assistance for housing costs such as rent or mortgage or utility payment. We can assist them with car payments, for purchase of a vehicle, for purchase of appliances, and also, you know, for assistance with clothing and with school supplies for their families.
And so, you know, DHS has spent about $15 million of TANF funds to assist about 2,500 families through this Maui recovery program. So they are working to spend down these dollars. Right now, the reserve is just extremely high. And so they're trying to look at different creative ways, you know, to spend down those monies and get them to people who are in need. But there's another, you know, potential emergency looming, which is cuts to federal assistance, like we were saying at the start of the segment, like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
It wasn't purposeful to let that much accumulate. It is rather convenient right now that we're heading into some reductions in our federal programs to have a little more to give. So, for example, starting very soon, certain groups that used to qualify for SNAP food benefits without working are now going to have work requirements imposed on them that they may or may not be able to meet. And so having more in the system, and while we can't directly make up for just, you know, target just those individuals for food assistance to make up for what they're losing, just having more programs will allow people to move their resources around and hopefully be better off.
Sorry, I forgot to introduce who that person was talking. That was Representative Lisa Martin, who chairs the Human Services Committee in the House. And so she's talking about how, you know, now that because the TANF funds, there's so much that has been accumulated, there's not really a way that the state can say, you know, these people are no longer eligible for SNAP benefits, so we're going to replace that with TANF. It doesn't work like that. But what she's saying is that these TANF funds can be used to set up many other different types of programs that do qualify under this TANF funding to maybe alleviate the pressures on families who have lost that assistance, but can kind of rejigger their budgets around by, you know, using assistance for other things, this TANF assistance for other aspects, things like job training or, you know, after school programs, things like that. And so that's one way that these TANF reserves could be used to mitigate the impacts from the cuts to federal funding to SNAP and other things, even like Medicaid as they come down in 2028.
Yeah, I know with SNAP, I know, you know, one concern that I've heard raised is like on Molokai, right? If there are people there that need to then find jobs, you know, there may not be 30,000 jobs on Molokai, right? Or
right,
whatever the case may be. So those communities like that in those remote areas could be impacted.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the other things that's kind of difficult that the Department of Human Services here is trying to figure out is it's not super clear how much of an impact the cuts to SNAP will have on Hawaii when they go into effect in November, because that guidance from the United States Department of Agriculture about the cuts to SNAP came out on Friday. So that was less than a week ago. And that is, of course, from the what they're calling the One Big Beautiful Bill, the mega bill that Congress passed earlier this year. But because it didn't have an effective date, people thought that they would maybe have more time before the restrictions to SNAP went into place. So DHS is currently trying to understand what it's going to mean for people here since that guidance has come out last week. One of the biggest changes is more work requirements to be on the SNAP program. And so we're going to have to see in the coming days, you know, what is going to be the impact to the state here.
Yeah, because you got families with young children, right? That
right.
Be impacted.
Right, exactly. And, you know, one of them is that, you know, parents for children, before it was if your child is below 18, you wouldn't be subjected to these work requirements. But now that's dropping to children under 14 years old. So things like that. We'll see how that impacts what you hear.
Yeah, people are going to be scrambling.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ashley. Appreciate you covering the story. We've been hearing from HPR's Ashley Mizuo, who has been focusing on unspent federal funds for needy families.
This week on This American Life, Evan creates an AI version of himself and sends it into the world to see what happens.
Jesus, I'm talking to AI right now.
What makes you think that?
I don't know. Just the way you're talking, it seems a little stilted.
I get it. Sometimes we all wear different masks.
Can people tell the difference between you and AI? Not always. This week.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
This weekend on The Real Deal, it's the thunderous swinging, bopping sound of Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, heard in a couple of classic live recordings Saturday and Sunday night from 8 to 10 on HPR 1. Join me, Seth Marco, as we celebrate Art Blakey.
Energy in, energy out. That used to be the common wisdom about staying healthy and active. But researchers are finding that our genes play a key role in our risk for conditions like obesity and diabetes. And a gene variant found in Pacific Islander populations is one of the best examples of this genetic link. A decade ago, scientists began studying the genetics of 3,500 adult Samoans. At the time, the largest data set of Pacific Islander health. they discovered a variant in a gene called CREBRF, CREBRF. People from American Samoa, Tonga, and Hawaii have all been found to carry this variant. Nikki Holly is an associate professor of chronic disease epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. She's part of an advisory committee for a local initiative modeling itself off the Make America Healthy Again movement, popularized by Health and Human Service Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. It's called MASHA, Make America Samoa Healthy Again. Holly stopped by our studios on her way back from American Samoa and spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about her research. She explains why she calls the variant the bane of her existence.
This is a Pacific-wide gene variant that has this fascinating effect on health. So all else being equal, people with two copies of this gene variant are around 20 pounds heavier and an inch taller than somebody who does not have copies of the variant. So that translates to increased obesity risk. But what is so fascinating, and part of my comment about the bane of my existence, which I'll get to in a second, is the fact that at the same time, in the same individual, this gene variant offers some protection against diabetes. So these people who carry the variant are at greater risk of obesity, but at lower risk of diabetes, which is really confusing for everybody who listens to the public health messaging about the fact that obesity and diabetes travel together. And at the time when we discovered it, and I think to this day, it is the largest effect of any obesity gene that has ever been observed. So this is something that really has important implications for health. And it's the bane of my existence because for the last 10 years, we and many other groups around the world have been trying to figure out what exactly this gene does. And so it works in numerous pathways in the body. And what we are working on is trying to figure out particularly how it offers some level of protection against diabetes. So this is not, it's not deterministic. If you have the variant, you're not going to get diabetes. You may develop it, but probably a little bit later and at a little bit higher body weight than anybody else. But we're really trying to figure out what that pathway is by which it offers protection, because if we can figure that out, we can potentially replicate it in a pharmaceutical way. And the other aspect of the comment about the work in CREBRF is just that for anybody who works in this space, precision medicine, even though we're getting closer, still feels pretty far away for these communities who lack some basic health system infrastructure. And so we're also thinking about this variant as a way to potentially, you know, direct resources, risk stratify with the very limited resources. Could we direct these more effectively to people who we know are at higher risk because they carry this variant? So our work is constantly evolving, but in that space of trying to figure out how we can use the information about this gene variant to really impact practice.
Yeah. And I mean, you're a scientist, so you couch all these things in scientific terms. But ultimately, this question is like, can we prevent obesity? Can we prevent diabetes? These are big, impactful questions for our health, for the economy. Do you have any leading theories on the mechanism here?
What we think is happening, and other groups in New Zealand, in Auckland University in particular, are a little ahead of us in terms of really making a mark on understanding mechanism. But we think what it does, at least in terms of protection against diabetes, is make people who carry it very efficient at releasing insulin. So at its very core, diabetes is when our bodies are no longer able to regulate the ups and downs that we get in glucose levels, in sugar that we eat from food or just kind of natural fluctuation throughout the day. And what we think this variant does is make our bodies very efficient at releasing insulin, which is the hormone that kind of keeps our blood glucose in a steady state over the course of the day. And if we could learn that and show that, then that would have implications for therapy, because insulin is a first-line treatment for many people who have type 2 diabetes. It's not the current first-line in American Samoa or in Samoa, who are more reliant on some tablet-based therapies. But we're hoping that the mechanism is going to guide us in terms of what the right treatment is for type 2 diabetes mm-hmm. in this particular population.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the clinical trial that's enrolling around this big topic?
Yeah, so we actually have two epidemiological studies right now that are trying to figure out both what this gene variant does in the context of gestational diabetes, so the type of diabetes that you develop during pregnancy, which is a really amazing lens through which to look at long-term diabetes risk, because diabetes that shows up in pregnancy means that you're probably at about 8 times higher risk postpartum after you have the baby of developing type 2 diabetes. So it's a really kind of nice early warning sign for type 2 diabetes. So we're looking at this gene variant in the context of gestational diabetes and trying to figure out what it does in terms of conferring risk for gestational diabetes and then conversion to postpartum type 2 diabetes. And then we're also looking at the impact on the babies. So one of the things that we know very concretely about both obesity and diabetes is that the origins of these diseases are very early in life. So for sure, your in utero environment during pregnancy has an impact on your lifelong risk. Your early childhood growth has an impact on long-term risk of these diseases. And so we're also looking in these epidemiological studies at the impact of the gene variant in relation to and in combination with gestational diabetes and its association with childhood health and development.
One of the things I just thought was really neat on your lab's website, the data sharing that you do with interested groups and parties, and even going back to some of that first research looking at a cohort of thousands, so much of that data scientists can now go to when they have other questions and ask it, so they're not doing the same work twice.
Yeah, so this is a really important, I think, feature of the work that we try and do. The genetic data sharing is interesting. There is hesitation around the world about accessibility of genetic data, and this is something that we have very carefully communicated with community partners about. There is an altruism that exists in Samoa that is just beautiful. And I think at the level of both the participants and the government partners, there's a thought that if this data is available and accessible, then maybe there are discoveries that can be made that can help Samoan communities, whether they are in Samoa or outside. And we have seen that. We have seen clinicians in New Zealand and Australia reach out to us about cases of rare disease where the families are of Pacific Islander ethnicity, and they have been able to learn something from our data set that has led them to a diagnosis. So that is super cool. On the non-genetic side, in terms of sharing information, I mean, we put so much work and so much careful thought into developing really good consent processes and really effective tools at measuring particularly behavioral risk factors. And it doesn't make sense that anybody else then has to reinvent the wheel, because also it's not fair to ask community partners or participants to repeat something just because it's a different group of scientists that show up. And so we're very open about sharing tools and instruments and our consent procedures and our space and our resources, because we have been so privileged to work there. We feel like this is just a small thing that we can do to kind of give back in general.
Listeners might be wondering, how can this information apply to their life and their lifestyle habits and choices and whether they have this genetic variant? So is it too early to give some recommendations or just some food for thought for them?
Yeah, of course. I mean, so one of the things that I will say, I started out talking about how we discovered this gene variant in Samoa, but then we have learned that it's a Pacific-wide trait. And so I think around 25% of people who have a native Hawaiian background probably have at least one copy of this variant. And so it's very relevant to what is happening here. I know, again, that this is not deterministic. Having this variant does not mean either that you will have obesity or that you will be protected from diabetes, but it just is a component. And so one of the things that it has done very nicely is also take a little bit of the pressure off Samoan communities who were kind of looked at as having all of these incredible behavioral risk factors, when actually there is a genetic component of this that cannot be ignored. It's a 20-pound difference between people who have two copies and do not. So it's a considerable contributor to at least obesity risk. I think, you know, we are discovering in both places how complicated the questions about obesity and diabetes are. And they are, to some degree, about individual level behavior. And we all hear the advice from the U.S. Dietary Guidelines, which is very good advice to think about our nutrient intake and think about our physical activity, both for physical as well as mental health. And so I think that that advice certainly applies to everybody, regardless of where they're from. But there are also things that we're learning about the food environment. Certainly for Hawaii, in a similar way as American Samoa, a lot of food is being imported. There's a lot of ultra-processed foods. There is construction and environmental changes as everywhere becomes more modern and reliant on technology that are contributing to a more sedentary lifestyle. And so I think that everything that we are doing out in the Pacific probably applies very much here in terms of just common sense public health mm-hmm. approaches to obesity and diabetes that are effective.
Yeah, and that aren't patient or person blamey, which yeah. I think people have probably correctly argued was for a while the way that you would talk about obesity.
So there is a famous story that my father hates me telling, and the fact that I'm telling this on the radio is gonna horrify him, but hopefully he'll get a kick out of it. I had been an assistant professor at Yale for maybe 3 or 4 years, and it's Christmas dinner. We have some family friends over, and I'm explaining what I do and my work in the Pacific, and my dad pipes up and says, I don't really understand why Yale employs you. And I, after being taken aback, kind of questioned him a little bit. And he said, well, obesity is just energy in, energy out. And why does this have to go further than telling people to think about what they eat and how much they move? And it wasn't the time to talk about it, but it has led me in every class and every presentation that I give to show this amazing diagram that came out of the UK Obesity Task Force that tries to picture all of the different causes of obesity and then interrelate them. And for radio, this thing looks like a plate of spaghetti. And it is just the most complex, complicated disease to try and get to the bottom of that has individual level components. But it was also about your family interactions and your social interactions and the environment where you go to school and the environment where you work and the decisions that food manufacturers are making about the foods that reach our food supply. So yeah, I really make a point to tell people that this is such a complicated, challenging problem to solve on a population level. But we all have to pick somewhere to start. And so that's what we're trying to do.
That was epidemiologist Nikki Holly of the Yale School of Public Health. She spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about research in American Samoa. Look for links to find out more about their findings on our website later today.
HPR is always looking deeper at the big issues impacting our state, like the second anniversary of the Lahaina fires this past August and the state of recovery for survivors.
Before the fire, it was hard enough. Since the fire, it's just gotten harder.
Every single person is at such a different place. So many different stories, so many different situations.
There's all holly cord on there, cane grass, buffalo grass, and it's the fuel that burnt down our town, burnt down my house. So I was tired of looking at that. So after the fire, I don't know, we just plant on tree. And lo and behold, this is where we're at. This place now restores and heals equally as much as we restoring the land. It restores us.
Empowered journalism that keeps you informed on the important news and stories impacting Hawaii. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
The world lost a powerhouse in the primate world this month. Dr. Jane Goodall passed away at the age of 91. She was on her U.S. speaking tour, part of her tireless outreach schedule that she's maintained for decades. She regularly spent 300 days out of the year traveling the world with her message of hope and possibility. She was known for saying, "What you do makes a difference, and you have to decide what kind of difference you want to make." Ecologist Sean Lum was raised in Honolulu and now lives in Singapore. Lum volunteers and serves on the board of the Jane Goodall Institute Singapore, and he's been a speaker alongside Goodall for events hosted by the Institute. He spoke with HPR's Lillian Song to reflect on the legacy of Dr. Jane, not just in the world of science, but also in conservation and peace.
I guess like anybody else, we all have a public-facing side or persona as well as a private side. And it was really amazing just to see how she managed. And I don't know how she did it because she was traveling and with big crowds everywhere and having the adulation, the attention that she received. She did it because she felt she had to. It was her mission to really spread the message of hope and looking after not just nature and environment and animals, but people as well. And she would often say, especially in later years, she would always make it a point to say, so long as my mind and body allow me, she will keep going and spreading this message until that mind or body fail her. And that's exactly what she did. She was on a tour. She was going to go plant trees after giving a talk the next day, and didn't happen. Mm. But yeah, she was going to do it.
Wow. And Dr. Jane Goodall has done so much. I mean, she was 91 years old, but still following that call, that mission she brought with her everywhere she went. And for you in Singapore, when was the first time you were able to work with her?
I think the first time I heard her speak locally was about 20 years ago, 2007 or so. And we have a locally based person from Washington by the name of Richard Hartung. And he was close to a former boss who lived in Taiwan, a man named Boon. Jane Goodall had helped establish a very thriving, vibrant Roots and Shoots program and Jane Goodall Institute in Taiwan. And it was through this Taiwan connection that Richard Hartung was able to reach out to JGI, the Jane Goodall Institute, and to his old mentor in Taiwan. And I think that's what drove the establishment of the Jane Goodall Institute Singapore. And I moderated a few talks that she gave in about 2009.
For our listeners new to the idea of Roots and Shoots, this youth movement of the Jane Goodall Institute, could you explain what it is?
Yes. The first Roots and Shoots chapter was established in Tanzania, which is Dr. Jane's second home, if you want to, spiritual home, because that's where at the Gombe, what is now the Gombe National Park, she began her revolutionary studies of chimpanzee behavior. So she really saw young people who, and this was back in, you know, this is the 80s, some time ago, you know, she would see youth. She said wherever she went on these tours, she would see young people who had almost given up in response to this degrading environment, and the future prospects had felt like there was very little hope for a bright future, not just for themselves, but for the planet and humanity. And I think she wanted to address that through Roots and Shoots, and its grassroots level. And Roots and Shoots clubs are asked to do one of three things: do something for animals, do something for the environment, or do something for your community. So it's not just taking care of wildlife. It could be like you could do stream restoration, clean up the beach. In the case of Honolulu, maybe you could get a group of students looking at stream life or observing the monk seal. Or you could maybe look after the elderly or tutor children. So it's really about getting people, how would you say, stuck in there to do things that make you feel better and that contribute positively to your community. And Roots and Shoots has grown. There are thousands of Roots and Shoots chapters all over the world. And the other nice thing about Roots and Shoots is it is a community. So you could, if you can find a Roots and Shoots organization, you are welcomed. And that is very much a Dr. Jane thing, this idea of community and reaching across differences and doing things together.
In reading up on Roots and Shoots, I really love this quote: roots creep under the ground to make a firm foundation. Shoots seem new and small, but to reach the light, they can break through brick walls.
That's right. So that was the other uncanny thing. She had this ability to actually show people that no matter how small an action, it has meaning and value, and it can become significant when you add up all these little actions of many people all over the world.
Right. And so for you, Sean, as you were also able to moderate some of the talks that she had in Singapore, what was it like to have that firsthand experience to be in the room where Dr. Jane Goodall was actually talking?
So you can, if you go onto YouTube, you can see her talks, and she will usually greet her audience with essentially it's the welcome call of an adult chimpanzee. So it's, what do they call it? They do a pant hoot. So it starts like very low, this very slow drawn out call, and then it crescendos and then suddenly goes quiet again. It slows down. Then she'll just translate it into English.
That simply means this is me, this is Jane. And
that really sets this amazing tone where, and it's like you could have a 500 people in the audience, and when she starts that pant hoot greeting call, and it's very powerful and resonant, and the audience just goes quiet, just absolutely quiet, and it reverberates in that room, and then and she says hello, and then starts her talk. You could listen to that 100 times, that greeting, and the same pant hoot call, but it's pretty magic. She also would use stories of regular people doing remarkable things. So she had, if you see photos of her, she has a small kind of monkey. She names Mr. H. Why H? It's the surname of her friend Gary, who's a blind magician who never let his handicap or his impediment restrict or limit his ambitions to be a magician. And that was her traveling companion for over 20 years, Mr. H. Then she, in recent years, would travel with a second animal who was a small little pig. And the reason is she would give examples of, a pig from South Africa who had been rescued from the abattoir, from the slaughterhouse, and raised as a family pet. And that pig, who was nicknamed or later named Pig Casso, used to watch his owner, who was a painter, and the owner of Picasso thought, this pig seems quite interested, so handed Picasso a brush, and it turns out that the pig could do quite beautiful, evocative, very sensitive paintings. And so she used that as an example of how animals have personalities, have feelings, have interests in ways that we would never give them credit for. And again, I think that ties in very nicely with both her outlook on other creatures, that they have value and they're sentient and they are interesting as personalities, not just as wildlife. And that ties in very nicely with the research that she'd become famous for.
Amazing in what she's done in the decades that she's been so active and making a point to share her message for humanity. We are all connected. We're all on the same globe. And so for you, Sean, when you think about what she's done, what she's left for the next generation, each person is accountable and we affect each other. So what is that personal message that you can leave our listeners with?
Again, that message of hope is one that she traveled the world for almost daily for 50 years. So we have a reason to hope, no matter how bad things look, we have it within ourselves and between each other to make positive change. And she talks about her reasons for hope, the human intellect. We can solve things. We have the tools to do it. The other one would be, if you let nature recover, the resilience of nature, the environment can come back. Just need to give it a chance, do the right things. The other thing is that there is what you call the indomitable human spirit. When we're really up against it, we find ourselves capable of doing the extraordinary, and the power and energy of youth. We have this all around us. Not all of us can be a Nelson Mandela or a Pope Francis or a Jane Goodall and just kind of reach, touch people in a very profound way. But we can do all the things that Jane Goodall believes we can and should do to give ourselves and each other and humanity hope. Yeah, she says, no matter how bad things look, there's always hope. We have to act on it. It's not just a passive thing and you hope that it comes to you, but you have the hope, you have the ability, you make it happen. And she certainly lived that. She really lived these principles. But then there are other kind of cute things that she would do. For example, let's say there's a tree planting. She always made it a point. She said, if I plant a tree, no tree planting is complete without she will give it a kiss. That's her approach. And this, I'm not making this up, Lily. And I've seen some of these trees that she's planted. And that one almost always is the fastest growing one.
She fertilized it with love. Her aloha imbued into this tree.
With love. Aloha, exactly. Everything she does was. So you could say that the spirit of the islands, this idea of aloha, she lived it. She lived it. And also you see it in the little things. So wherever she went, let's say there was the local Jane Goodall Institute. So the people who made her visit possible, she would always, like her last day, she would do engagements from the afternoon onwards. So she, the morning was for her to read, to think, to write. And always after she would leave a place, she would leave behind a stack of notes, a thank you note to every person who had done something, you know. So that's not just the big, the grand speeches and gestures, just these little things too, to tell people that they were appreciated. No matter who you were, everybody mattered. Everybody was deserving of your aloha. You know that she had a tradition, so she had a wicked sense of humor, and she had a tradition with her mother where they would, wherever they were in the world, at 7 p.m., their local time, they would have just a little sip of whiskey and toast each other. She did like her whiskey, Dr. Jane, but as a way of connecting again. And so I think in one interview, she pointed out, even after her mother passed away, she would still toast to the clouds. And that was her little ritual to connect with and remember her mother. Yeah. So when she passed, I think many, all the people who loved her, I think the word got around that at 7 p.m., wherever you are, just raise your glass and remember her.
Oh, thank you, Sean. Thank you for sharing your memories.
Yeah, no, all of us, again, it's this idea that all of us are capable of doing really meaningful and important and wonderful things. We've just got to have the belief in ourselves and hope that we together can make change happen. In Hawaii, we already have this spirit that we feel is important and that defines us as a community. And so we might be as well placed as anyone to actually kind of push forward with this agenda of hope, of peace, of being inclusive and encouraging.
That was ecologist Sean Lum, board member of the Jane Goodall Institute, Singapore, and HPR's Lillian Song. The Institute's mission is to nurture the next generation of Jane Goodalls by empowering and inspiring people to take action. Lum says his team of volunteers promote coexistence with local primate species through community education and programs like monkey guarding to manage human-wildlife conflict. You can catch Lum in conversation with his sister, Shireen Lum Taba, on Mondays during Classical Pacific on HPR2. Well, that's it for us today. Tomorrow, the state's largest government union speaks up on behalf of federal workers. We do welcome your feedback. Have you been impacted by the government shutdown? Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.